"Have you made arrangements with the hotel?" my father said, with finality, and I knew it had been settled long before. Chapter 10. Nairobi had grown in leaps since I was there at school. 10,000 people now perched on the scrubby verge of the Athi Plains, with the tin-roofed shops and public houses and the noisy and colourful bazaar. Even this much civilization was a wonder. The town had been formed accidentally when the Uganda Railway was being forged between Mombasa and Lake Victoria in 1899. A flimsy headquarters went up, then an anchovy tin shack the workers had dubbed the Railhead Club, then more shacks and tents, and when the railway finally moved on, a town was left in its wake. But even then, no one guessed how important the railway would become for the British Empire and the whole of the continent. Building the route was expensive, and maintaining it even more so. Colonial officials concocted a scheme to draw white settlers to the area by offering parcels of land for nearly nothing. Retired soldiers like my father, Andy, received additional land as part of a pension. And this was how the colony went up, man by man, farm by farm, with Nairobi as its steadily beating heart. By 1919, there was a government house with a ballroom on Nairobi's Central Hill, a racetrack, and three good hotels. To reach town, we only had to board the train and travel 113 miles through dusty bush and red murram mud and papyrus swamp. A full day spent on the sooty, lurching iron contraption so I could stand in a rented room at the New Stanley Hotel in a frock the colour of egg custard. The frock was probably very pretty. Emma had picked it out and insisted it was perfect. But the stiff lace crimped too high on my neck and gave me a rash I couldn't scratch at. There was a crown of roses, too, tight yellow-pink buds sewn together in a circlet. I kept looking in the mirror, wondering if I looked right, and hoping I did. "What do you think, really?" I asked Doss, who stood behind me in her slip, pulling pins from her bobbed brown hair. "You're lovely, but stop scratching, will you? Everyone will think you've got fleas." Doss was still a student, currently at Miss Secom's in town, and we had almost nothing in common. She was curvy, brown, and tiny in her blue lace frock, good at conversation and the usual pleasantries, easy in the company of others. I was rail thin, a head taller than Doss, even in flat shoes, and far more comfortable talking to horses and dogs than people. We were as mismatched as 2 16-year-old girls could be, but I was still fond of Doss, and glad she was here. At 10 p.m. sharp, according to a silly British custom, I gripped my father's arm on the stairs. I only ever saw him in dusty khakis and sun helmet, but his dark tails and white shirt front looked natural on him, reminding me of the life he'd led before, in England. There I would have been formally presented to the king at court, in a procession of other well-born young women in pearls and gloves and ostrich feathers, curtsying my heart out. In this far-flung colony, where sovereignty was a flag and a notion, and sometimes a few rousing verses of "God Save the King" that had everyone in tears, I was brought out to a hotel ballroom full of ranchers, former soldiers, and Afrikaners, all soaked clean and half-pickled. A five-piece band played the lilting opening to "If You Were the Only Girl in the World," the cue for my father and me to take our turn on the dance floor. "I'm going to step on your toes now," I warned.
"Go on, then. I won't make faces and give you away."
He danced beautifully, and I did my best to keep up, concentrating on his grey wool tailcoat, which smelled faintly of the cedar chest it had been pulled from the day before. I had to hunch a bit to keep from towering over him, and this made me feel more awkward than I already did.
"You know, they don't hand out manuals for the tough stuff," he said as the band slowed. "I haven't always known what to do as a father, but somehow you've turned out all right." Before I could really take in what he'd said, or make the moment last, he stepped away in one move, passing my right hand to Lord Delamere.
"Look at you, Beryl. Pretty as a filly,"
Dee said. He had come out of the war, looking older by a dozen years. There were deep lines around his eyes, and his hair had gone white in a bad bout of fever, but he'd come through. I rarely saw him now. He still owned Equator Ranch, but had moved on to another ranching operation south and east of us, on the chalky shores of Lake Elmentata.
"Florence should be here," he said against my shoulder. "She would have been so proud."
I felt a sharp, plunging sensation from the tender way Dee had said her name, and told him I still thought about her every day. "It's not fair she's gone."
"Not a bit."
And then he kissed my cheek before smoothly passing me on to the next in line. It took me several dances to clear the dip in my mood, but the fellows partnering me didn't seem to notice or mind. For an hour or more I was spun in a press of warm-shaved faces, strong hands and damp ones, good dancers and ones with clumsy sidesteps. I tasted champagne on the back of my tongue as a lone trumpet swooned the verses I knew but didn't sing. A garden of Eden just made for two, with nothing to mar our joy. I would say such wonderful things to you. There would be such wonderful things to do if you were the only girl in the world.
And then there was Jock, Purvis, as my father called him, looking a good deal cleaner than he had done twisting fence wire, and more handsome now that we were nose to nose. When he spun me close, I smelled shaving powder and gin, and though I didn't have the slightest bit of experience with men or swooning, I could tell by Doss's look, as we came past her table again, that it was high time I learned. There were lots of men like Jock in town, discharged soldiers who'd taken their settlement allotment and snatched up acreage, trying to reinvent themselves in a purposeful way, but few were as handsome. He was strong-looking and squared off everywhere, shoulders and jaw and chin. This was what a man was supposed to be, I thought, if you could build him from scratch and break him in like new land.
"Is your fence still standing?" I asked him.
"Why wouldn't it be?"
"Any number of things," I laughed.
"Starting with marauding elephants. You think I'm funny?"
"No," I let my voice trail off.
"A certain kind of man comes to Africa and builds fences. Is that what you think?"
"How should I know?" I threw out. "I'm only 16.
"You were never 16.
He was flattering me, but I didn't mind much. I'd had 3 glasses of champagne by then, and everything was beginning to seem wonderful. Jock's dark jacket under my hand, the band in an alcove opposite the bar. The tuba was a golden blur. The horn player seemed to be winking at me. And then there were the other partnered girls sailing by us in silk dresses, gardenias tucked like stars into their hair. Where did all these girls come from? I've never seen half of them." He glanced around. "You outshine them." Out on the farm, there'd been no occasion to flirt. I hadn't learned how to try to draw a man in, so I simply said what I thought, even though it stamped me as insecure. "Emma says I don't paint well.
All that rouge and face powder has to come off at some point.
Maybe it's better you don't." We danced for half a minute in silence, and then he said,
"These town girls all come from the same box of sweets anyway."
"I think I'll marry you instead."
"What?"
I breathed, caught off guard. He grinned, his teeth neat and shiny and square.
"You are wearing a white dress."
"Oh." I leaned back in his arms and felt my head go woozy. Sometime later, I went to sit near Doss at one of the cloth-draped tables. Her chin was propped up on one of her hands. A gin fizz foamed in the other.
"He's lovely," she said. You dance with him, then. He makes me nervous. He hasn't looked at me twice. How do you know?
She laughed at me. Really, Beryl.
You're so thick.
Why wouldn't I be?
I glared at her.
It's all so stupid anyway. Half the fellows have sweat pouring off them, and the other half look right over my shoulder as if I'm not there. Well, at least the ones who are tall enough.
I'm sorry, she said, softening. I was only teasing. You'll learn.
I made a face at her and pulled at the neck of my dress.
Want to smoke?
You go. It might be my only chance for a little male attention.
You look grand,
she smiled. I'll look better with you outside. On the street, it was dark in the way only Africa can be. I took a deep breath, tasting dust and eucalyptus, and moved past the smeary lights of the veranda. In the small park across the road, smooth clay had been spread like a dusting of confectioner's sugar, and a dotted line of dwarf gum trees newly planted for effect. This was Nairobi trying to civilize itself, but a greater emptiness stretched out beyond it, ready to swallow every last stitch of all of us. I loved that about Africa, and hoped it would never change. Strolling, I felt the dark tug at me, and a pleasant itch to be out of my dress, out of my skin even.
You look like Diana,
an English voice said, startling me. A man stood in the street behind me, in a well-fitting evening jacket and trousers, both white as the moon.
I'm sorry?
Diana the Huntress, he clarified. From the Romans.
He was drunk, I realized, but still pleasant for all that. A fat bottle of wine sloshed against his leg, and when he smiled, I saw he had a wonderful face, at least in the dark.
I'm Finch Hatton. Or maybe I'm Verbius.
More Romans?
That's right.
He looked at me more closely, tipping his head. He was taller than I was, when so very few men were.
You look as if you've been to a party.
So do you. This one's for me.
I pointed my chin in the direction of the hotel.
Your wedding party?
I laughed.
My coming out.
Good then. Never marry. Diana's don't, as a rule.
He stepped a little nearer, and I could better see his face under the rim of his dark bowler. His eyes were large and heavily lidded. His cheekbones were strong, and his nose was sharp and fine.
Do you feel ready for society, then?
He asked.
I'm not sure. Can anyone tell you when you're grown up?
Another man came around the corner near the hotel and was walking towards us with purpose. He carried himself like a prince, too, and had a thick combed moustache, reddish hair, and no hat.
Dennis, finally, he said with a dramatic sigh. You've led me quite a chase.
He bowed at the waist in a way that was probably meant to be funny.
Barclay Cole, at your service.
Beryl Clutterbuck.
Clut's daughter.
He peered at me.
Yes, I catch the resemblance now. I know your father from the race meetings. There isn't a man who's better with horses. Miss Clutterbuck and I have been discussing the perils of marriage. You're drunk, Dennis,
Barclay clucked, then turned to me.
Don't let him frighten you.
I'm not a bit frightened.
See?
Dennis said. He tipped the wine bottle into his mouth and then brushed stray drops away with the back of his hand.
Have you ever seen stars like this? You can't have. They don't make them like this anywhere in the world.
Above our heads, the sky was a brimming treasure box. Some of the stars seemed to want to pull free and leap down onto my shoulders. And though these were the only ones I had ever known, I believed Dennis when he said they were the finest. I thought I might believe anything he said, in fact, even though we had just met. He had that in him.
Do you know any Keats?
Dennis asked after several minutes of stillness. Then, when I was clearly confused,
it's poetry.
Oh, I don't know any poetry.
Barclay, give us something about the stars. Barclay mused. How about Shelley?
Wrap thy form in a mantle grey, star inwrought. Blind with thine hair the eyes of day. Kiss her until she be wearied out. Then wander o'er city, and sea, and land, touching all with thine opiate wand.
Kiss her until she be wearied out, Dennis repeated. That's the best bit, isn't it? And Barclay does it so well.
Wonderful.
My father had read the classics to me by firelight sometimes, but that had felt like school.
This was more like a song, and also like being alone in the wild with your thoughts. Somehow it was both at the same time.
While Shelley's words still hung there, Dennis began to recite something else, quietly, as if only for himself.
This is thy hour, O soul, thy free flight into the wordless. Away from books, away from art, the day erased, the lesson done. Thee fully forth emerging, silent, gazing, pondering the themes thou lovest best. Night, sleep, death, and the stars.
The words were so natural for him they took no effort at all. You couldn't learn that, no matter how much you tried. Even I recognized it, feeling a little small. That's Shelley again.
Whitman, actually. He smiled at me.
Should I be embarrassed not to have heard of him? I told you I don't know anything about poetry.
It only takes practice, you know. If you really want to learn, do it. Take some poetry every day.
Like your quinine for malaria,
Barclay added.
A measure of good champagne helps too. I don't know what it is about Africa, but champagne is absolutely compulsory here.
Without any further ceremony, Dennis tipped his hat to me, and then the two men moved off down the road, turning a corner and passing out of sight. They might have been headed to another party, or to white steeds waiting to whisk them off to an enchanted palace. I would have believed a magic carpet as well, or any storybook ending. They were that lovely. And now, they were gone.
Are you drunk? Emma said when I went back inside.
I might be.
She pursed her lips tightly, fed up, and moved off just as Jock was stepping towards me.
I've been looking for you everywhere, he said, taking my arm.
Without saying anything, I reached for the champagne flute he held and downed it in one go. It was a dramatic gesture, but there were bits of verse still swirling in my head like the milky trails of stars. There was the picture of two beautiful men in white jackets at the untamed edge of town, and the idea that the world was far bigger than I'd ever imagined, and that all sorts of things would happen to me. Things already were happening to change my life forever, even if I didn't quite know what they meant. There was only the promise for the moment, as exhilarating as the feeling of champagne fizzing and dancing on my tongue.
Compulsory, Barclay Cole had called it. Let's have some more of this, I told Jock, lifting the glass. And then, as we made our way towards the bar,
do you know any poetry?
Chapter 11. A few weeks later, my father and I met the train from Nairobi at Kambi Yamoto Station, down the hill from our farm. The engine settled and breathed hard in place, like a small dragon home from war. Smoke chuffed and streamed out behind, marring the flat sky, while half a dozen men bent in two alongside the sooty freight cars, readying a wooden ramp. Six of our horses were returning home victorious from the turf club in town, including Cam, Bar One, and My Pegasus. Cam had taken the cup and a £100 purse, but now, as we stood on the short platform and waited for Emma to come round with the Hudson, my father didn't want to talk about our winning runs.
He wanted to talk about Jock. Do you like him at all?
He asked, looking up the hill into the sun.
I suppose he's all right. He'll make that farm work.
He chewed lightly for a moment at the corner of his lip.
He will.
And then,
he's serious about you.
What? I spun on him. We've only just met.
He smiled wryly. I'm not sure that's a detriment in marriage.
Why is everyone so keen to find me a husband? I'm too young for all of that.
Not really. There are plenty of girls your age who've been dreaming about husbands and families for years. You'll want to be taken care of one day, won't you?
Why? We're doing all right as we are.
Before my father could say anything more, the silly klaxon punched through the air over the hill. We heard the low metallic clanking of the motorized buggy, and as it nosed into view, I saw Emma at the wheel, bouncing on the hard leather seat. She pulled up to us, idling.
Where's your hat, Beryl? You'll get freckles in this sun.
I wasn't sure how our success in Nairobi could dissolve so quickly, but that night at dinner, my father was silent and remote, while Emma came forward, peevish about the soup. It was a thin broth with turbot and potatoes, and small coins of leeks.
The fish is off. Don't you think, Charles?
She pushed her bowl away and raised her voice to call the houseboy, Kamotho. When he appeared in his white coat and small velvet fez, Emma told him it should all go back.
And we'll eat what? Bread and butter?
My father put up a hand to stay the confused Kamotho.
Leave it alone, Emma.
Now you care what I do?
That's rich.
Her words clattered in the air above the table.
What is this all about?
I finally brought myself to ask. My father looked pained. He asked Kamotho to leave us, and as the boy slunk off gratefully, I wished that I could join him. I didn't want to hear what came next.
It's the damned rupee, he finally said, squeezing one of his hands in the other. I went to bed last week owing 5,000, and now it's 7,500, with 8% interest on all of it. I can't climb out this time.
He's taken a training post in Cape Town, Emma pronounced coldly. The farm is finished.
What? I felt myself rocking dangerously off center.
Farming's a gamble, Beryl. It always has been.
And Cape Town isn't a gamble?
I shook my head, barely able to grasp what was happening.
They love horses there. I'll make a fresh start. Maybe the change will be lucky.
Lucky, I repeated flatly. In my room that night, I turned the lamp lower and lay there feeling stunned. Shadows came creeping and sighing over my bed. The post still hung with beads and pouches of feathery animal bones. It gave me a kind of vertigo thinking about how quickly my whole life could shift away from under me. Our stables were still filled and perfectly run. 84 matchless animals that had won my father a golden reputation and strings of solid wins. In the morning, the stable bell would ring, and everyone and everything would wake as they always had. The mill would turn. The horses would canter and stamp in the paddock and churn loose hay in their boxes. But none of it was real anymore. We lived on a ghost farm. Chapter 12. When the moon climbed above the camphor trees beside my hut, light streamed in through the open windows, yellowing the tops of the shelves and boxes. I dressed quickly in trousers and moccasins and a long-sleeved shirt, and then headed out into the cool, dry night. There was to be an Ngoma that night, as there always was for full moons, a tribal dance of the young Kikuyu men and women, up the high embankment at the far edge of the forest. I headed there, with Buller at my heels, listening for anything that might want to do me harm, and thinking about my father. Earlier that night, I'd found him behind his paper-strewn desk, working on the lists he'd begun to collect of interested buyers for the horses. The surrender in it,
seemed to have cut new lines around his brown eyes. "Is Emma going along to Cape Town?" I asked him.
"Of course."
"Will I go?"
"If that's what you want."
Goose flesh prickled the back of my neck. "What else would I do?"
"Stay here and make your own start as a farmer's wife, I suppose."
"Marry Jock?" My words came out in an unsteady rush.
"It's clear he's ready to settle down, and he wants you."
"I'm only 16.
"Well," he shrugged, "no one's forcing you. If you want to come along, we'll be starting all over from the beginning, working for someone else."
He returned to his lists, and I studied the top of his head, the skin pale pink and vulnerable-looking under his thinning brown hair. Had I heard a hesitation in his voice? He said it was up to me, but something in his tone seemed to be nudging me gently away from Cape Town. "Does Emma not want me to go?"
"Honestly, Beryl."
He glanced up from shuffling his lists, looking exasperated.
"I have so much to worry about at the moment. This has nothing to do with you."
I went off to bed then, but I hadn't slept much or been able to think about anything else. Maybe my father's hard choices didn't have anything to do with me, but they were upending my life all the same and forcing me to make hard choices of my own, ones I had hoped never to make. Before I was even halfway up the steep ridge, I heard the ingoma. Drums set the air vibrating and rang through the ground under my feet as if something were tunneling powerfully in every direction at once. Smoke rose in a coil above the ridge, then high-licking flames and cinders. Finally, I was on level ground and could see the dancers, alive with movement, and the encompassing circle of those who watched, too young or too old to join in. At the center of the beaten ring of earth, the fire danced too, giving off a singed smell and painting a luster on limbs and faces. The young women had smooth-shaved heads dressed with strings of beads. More beads swept in long looping chains over the tight leather strappings of their clothes. They weren't much older than me, but they looked older, dressed like this, and as if they knew something I didn't, and possibly never would. A few of the young men wore the long, white skins of serval cats on leather thongs around their waists. When the skins swung under their buttocks, the dots and dashes of the animals' coats shone, as if alive, then flicked between their legs as they pitched forward and back with the steps. The tribal chief bent back his neck and made a screeching caw I felt everywhere. The men called out, and the women responded, cry and mirroring cry, high and looping, filling the sky and slicing it open. Films of sweat caught the light and the vibrating skins of the drum. My breath quickened. My heart seemed to leave my body as the verses and refrains gathered speed like a great wheel. And just when the song reached its highest pitch, I looked across the blazing circle and saw Kibii. We had always come to these ngomas together as children, staying late and walking back home through the forest afterwards. Kibii, full of judgments about how the dancers could have been more graceful or more passionate. Now the two of us were rarely alone, and I couldn't remember the last time we'd been easy with one another. As the firelight painted shadows on him, I saw how much older and different he'd become. Instead of his usual shuka, he wore a finer one, knotted high on his left shoulder, and gathered at his waist with a beaded belt. There were black and white bands of monkey fur around both his ankles, and at his throat hung the hollowed claw of a lion. He was angled away from me, and his profile was a prince's, as it had always been, but with steelier edges. Finally he turned. His black eyes found mine over the licking flames, and my heart jumped. He was a Moran now. That's what had changed. He'd become a man.
I backed away from the circle, feeling hurt. We hadn't been close for a long time, but I still couldn't believe that Kibi could cross the most momentous threshold of his life without my hearing a whisper of it. I scanned the area for Bulla, wanting to be gone as quickly as possible, but didn't see him. I made off anyway, and had reached the edge of the ridge, readying myself for the steep descent, when I heard Kibi calling my name. The moon beamed down at the tangle of brushy plants and grasses that hid my feet from me. Even if I hurried, I knew he could easily catch me again. So I stayed.
"They say your father is leaving Njoro," Kibi said, when he'd reached me. "Is it true?"
I nodded. "For Cape Town." I didn't want to say anything about the money troubles. It was too shameful.
"There are plenty of good horses there, or so I have heard."
"You've become a moron," I said, wanting to talk of anything else. "You look very fine." Moonlight showed the pride on his face, but there was something else, too. I realized he didn't know how to be near me anymore.
"What will you do now?" he asked.
"I don't know, actually.
I've had a marriage proposal."
I thought he would be surprised, or show some reaction, but he only shrugged as if to say, "Of course," and then spoke a native phrase I'd heard before. "A new thing is good, though it be a sore place." "Are you ready for marriage?" I challenged him, not liking the authority and confidence in his voice, as if he'd already sorted out every piece of the puzzle that had made a muddle of my life. He shrugged again. "Why not?"
"I will go into the world first. The Ndito in my village aren't meant for me."
"The world is a big place. Do you know where you'll go?"
"My father told me of many places he traveled to. North as far as Kitale, south to Arusha, and to the slopes of Doña Kenya. Perhaps I will begin by walking where he has walked."
Arap Maina's last steps had been very far from here. I suspected Kibi was thinking of that place too, though he hadn't named it. "Do you still mean to find the soldier who killed Arap Maina?"
"Perhaps," he said. "Or perhaps I'll learn the difference between a boy's dreams and a man's."
He paused and then said, "When I marry, my father will live again in my sons." He sounded so arrogant, so sure of himself. It made me want to challenge him or put him right. I said, "The man who wants to marry me is very rich and strong. He lives near here. He built his house in 3 days.
"A proper house or a hut?" he wanted to know.
"A real house, with shingles and a pitched roof and glass windows." He was silent for a moment, and I was sure I'd finally impressed him.
"3 days," he said at last. "That is no wisdom in such hurrying. This house will not stand long."
"You haven't seen it." My voice rose with irritation.
"How can that matter?" he said. "I would ask him to build another dwelling, just for you, and to take more care."
He turned away, dismissing me, and said partly over his shoulder,
"You should know I have a Moran's name now. I am Arap Ruta."
All the way back to the farm, I smarted, running over the clever things I should have said to him. Things that would wound him and make him feel as small as I did now, and as outmatched.
Arap Ruta, indeed. I had known him since he wasn't any taller than a bush pig, and now he'd become worldly and wise after one night's ceremony, a sharp knife and a cupful of curdled bull's blood to drink.
As my thoughts buzzed and grated against one another, I realized that if Ruta had even the slightest notion of how scared I was about the coming changes, I would die. But I was scared, and full of confusion. Cape Town was a world away, and my father was going to be busy and worried there, focused on pleasing new owners and stable managers. I could trail him, trying to stay out of the way, or throw my lot in with Emma to set up house. What a thought that was. England was another choice too, I supposed. Or might be if I were another sort of girl. I might have considered writing to my mother, to see if there was room for me with her and Dickie. But England seemed even more foreign and distant a world than Cape Town in a way. And she had never once tried to reclaim me over the years. Asking for her help now would cost me too much, and open the door for all the old hurt again. No, never that, which left Jock. I didn't know the slightest thing about marriage, and the only happy union I'd ever seen modelled was Dee and Lady Dee, a foggy memory well behind me. The farm and our horses had always seemed better things to hitch my fate to. I hadn't even let myself imagine something else. But that was all dissolving now, moment by moment. I barely knew Jock, and didn't know why I'd caught his attention in the first place, other than that I hunted well, and he liked the way I looked. But marrying him would mean I could stay here in Njoro, seeing the same hills and distances, living the same sort of life. Did Jock fancy himself in love with me? Could I learn to love him? Everything was so murky suddenly, and it seemed even more unfair that while my future whirled sickeningly, Reuters was rolling out exactly as he'd always dreamed. For 10 years or more, he and I had played at besting each other, practicing fearlessness, stretching for more. The games had prepared Reuter for his future, and should have prepared me for mine too. The maneuvers had become riskier and more difficult, but maybe each was the same when you got down to it. Jumping had taught me how to jump, hadn't it? I only had to look at Reuter to know he wasn't a child anymore. Neither was I. The next afternoon, after I'd practiced the pronouncement over and over in my hut so I would sound certain of myself, I told my father I was going to stay in Njoro.
Good, he nodded, and tented his fingers studying me. I think that's best. Jock's sensible and not afraid to dirty his hands. I know he'll take care of you.
I can look out for myself, too, I bluffed, my pulse thudding in my ears. I had to pause and steady myself to say the next thing. Can I keep Pegasus?
You earned him, fair and square. He's not mine to take back.
He rose to get himself a drink. The peaty odor of scotch flickered up and stung my nose. I'd like one of those. He looked at me, surprised.
You'll have to go for water.
I shook my head.
All right, he said. I guess you've earned that too.
He handed me the rounded heavy glass, and we sat in silence as the sun retreated. I'd had wine and champagne. But this was different. It made me feel older.
We've had a good run here, haven't we? He asked.
I nodded, unable to reach words for anything I felt. I looked into my glass, letting the scotch burn through me. Chapter 13. Once I decided to say yes to Jock, everything moved with shocking speed. Our clothes were ordered, the priest engaged, paper invitations sent flying far and wide. Emma had very clear ideas about my dress, pearl-trimmed ivory satin, with embroidered rosettes and thistles on the train. And since I had no taste myself, I agreed to all her choices. Orange blossoms and long silk ninon for the veil. Slippers so thin and fine I couldn't imagine them lasting beyond the day. When gifts began arriving, a silver cake stand, filigreed napkin rings, a cut glass bud vase, various checks written out to Mr. and Mrs. Purvis, they were carefully put away in one corner of the house, while things belonging to Daddy and Emma were packed in crates and settled in other corners. It was dizzying to see the farm dissolving as my future was being planned, but I also understood It couldn't be any other way. Jock and I didn't spend more than a few moments alone in the weeks of hurried preparation and maneuvering. When we were, he squeezed my hands tightly in his and told me how happy we were going to be. He talked about the changes and expansions he would make to our farm, how ambitious he was for our future, how prosperity was surely just around the corner. I latched on to Jock's dreams, wanting to feel reassured. Hadn't Green Hills started with nothing long ago? Our new farm would grow and become wonderful, just like that. I had to believe it was possible, even as I waited to feel more for Jock himself.
"You're a fast worker," Doss squealed when I told her the news. "The last I heard, he made you nervous."
"He still does a bit," I confessed. "But I'm trying not to let on."
"It's not as if we have so many options here," she said. "I'll be a farmer's wife one day too, I imagine. At least he's dashing."
"You think it's all right then, that I'm not in love with him?"
"You will be, silly. At least you'll stay here where you belong, and he'll take care of you. Even if your father wasn't moving to Cape Town, he couldn't look out for you forever."
She smirked.
"Or so mine tells me, every chance he gets."
We were married at All Saints, on a sun-shocked Wednesday in October, 2 weeks before my 17th birthday. The legal marrying age was 18 then, but my father thought I was old enough, and that seemed good enough for me. At the church, I walked on his arm, keeping my eyes on Jock to hold me in place, as if I were going into battle with him. It did the trick until I reached him and the starch-collared reverend, and then my heart began to gallop. I worried that everyone could hear it, that they all knew or guessed that I had no love for this man. But love was dubious too, wasn't it? It certainly hadn't done much good for my mother and father, or Emma and my father, for that matter. Maybe being practical was one way to ensure I ended up differently from them. I hoped so as I gripped Jock's hand, finding the breath to say yes to the Reverend's long string of difficult questions, and then, "I will." Jock had a pal from the King's African Rifles who came to stand up for him, the tall and smart-looking Captain Lavender, with bright eyes and a cowlick that swept a wing of golden hair onto his forehead. It was Lavender who drove us to the Norfolk Hotel in Jock's yellow Bugatti. He sped through the streets of Nairobi, throwing me across the leather-back seat towards Jock, so that I nearly bruised myself against his clenched thighs. It had to mean something that he was so strong, I told myself. He would be able to hold me up and direct the forces around my life when my father was gone. I clamped onto that hope and didn't let it go as we stepped out and onto the long run of wooden steps to the hotel, everyone smiling for us, my dress and veil arranged like fondant, our picture taken for the papers, and for all time. 100 guests were herded into the dining room, which was dressed as finely as the place could muster. The event had flushed out the upcountry. The farmers who'd become soldiers, then farmers again. Dee was there, his hair long and wild under a ribboned helmet. A scabbard swung out from his belt, whacking at the air as he turned and tried to kiss me. He had given us a generous check, and let me know, a little sentimentally, that if I ever needed him, I had only to call out, and he'd be there. His promise touched me, and made me feel a little steadier, as I carried myself from guest to guest, holding the yards of silk ninon in my hands so I could walk without tripping. Under buttery gravy, there was the ubiquitous tommy steak with buttons of potatoes and pearled onions. My father was paying through the nose for the champagne, so I drank as much as I could every time it came round. When I danced later, my feet were slightly numb and tingled as I backed across the parquet, led by Dee, and every farmer who could scoot away from his wife. Finally, I reached my father. He looked dashing that night, but also sad. There were long lines around his mouth, and his eyes seemed tired and far away.
"Are you happy?" he asked.
I nodded into his shoulder and squeezed him more tightly. In the wee hours, Lavender chauffeured us again, this time to the Mutega Country Club, to a square room lit with a single crystal lamp. A broad bed swam with chenille. Jock and I didn't know each other. I felt that now, seeing the dense shape he made in the room, and wondering, in a dizzy way, how it would be when we lay down. I was drunk and glad for that, when Jock's hands tugged at my buttons. His tongue flicked around the inside of my mouth, both sour from the wine. I tried to match him, to be good at it, to catch up with what was happening. His mouth was hot on my neck. His hands dropped to push here and there along my body. We fell to the bed, and there was an absurd moment when he tried to squeeze between my legs, my long narrow skirt resisting him, and me trying to help. I laughed, and realized instantly that was the wrong thing. What did I know about sex? Nothing except what I saw in our paddocks, or had heard from Kibi about the games young Kip boys and girls played in the dark. I had no idea what to do, or how to arrange myself to be taken, but I did know that something meaningful had changed. Jock had been hard. I'd felt the stiff knot of his groin against my leg and hip. But that was gone now. Before I knew what was happening, he rolled off me and onto his back, his arm coming up to shield his eyes, as if there were a glaring lamp in the room instead of shadows. "I'm sorry," I finally said.
"No, no. I'm just done in. It's been a long day."
He rose on his elbow to give me a smacking kiss on the side of my cheek, and then turned away again to settle his pillow under him, punching it into place. I studied the lines of his neck and shoulders, my mind whirring. What had I done, or not done? Was it that I'd laughed at him? At us? As I lay there feeling stunned and confused, Jock began to snore lightly. How could he sleep at such a moment? It was our wedding night, and I was alone. I kicked my way out of my dress, and then washed my face in the basin, stripping off the paint and the waxy lipstick, being careful not to look in the mirror. I had packed only a flimsy nightgown, something Emma had found in a lace shop, and it was cold against my skin. Back in bed, I stretched out next to Jock's hulking form. He made a solid mountain, seeming to take up even more space now that he was unconscious. He breathed on gutturally, dreaming his unknowable dreams, while I lay there in the dark, willing myself to sleep. The next morning at Nairobi Station, we climbed aboard the train that would take us to Mombasa, and then onto the ship that would ferry us to India for our honeymoon. I was Beryl Purvis, and still a virgin. Chapter 14. In Bombay, the air was full of spices, and the crying sitars of street musicians. White bungalows crowded the lanes, with peeling shutters that closed at the hottest part of every day, and then opened again at night, when the sky went red and deep purple. We stayed with Jock's aunt and uncle, in their compound below the posh Malabar Hill. Jock's parents and two of his three brothers were there, having come to see if I was up to snuff. I wanted to have a long look at them all, too. The new family I'd won, as if in a lottery. On the voyage, Jock had told me how his family had moved to India from Edinburgh when he was a boy, but I found it hard to remember details of land holdings and business mergers when I stood and looked at them. A band of ruddy, high-boned Scots, in a silky brown Indian sea. Jock's mother was the pinkest of all, like a flamingo in bright silk. She wore her auburn hair in a high coil that was being quietly taken over by strands of pure white. Jock's father, Dr. William, was a version of Jock, with strong-looking hands and bright blue eyes that winked at me, trying to put me at ease, as his wife asked a string of questions that weren't really questions.
"You're very tall, aren't you?" she kept saying. Unnaturally so. Don't you think, Will?
I don't think I'd go so far to say unnatural, darling.
His brogue tipped the ends of his sentences up expectantly. I always thought he was about to say something more, but then he didn't. Jock patted my knee nervously.
It means she's healthy, Mother.
Well, she's got plenty of sun, hasn't she?
Later, when Jock and I were alone in our room, dressing for dinner, I studied myself in the full-length looking-glass. I wasn't used to frocks and stockings, or the strapped high-heeled shoes that were the fashion then. My stocking seams wouldn't line up straight. My new underthings, bought in Nairobi with Emma's instructions, pinched at my waist and under my arms. I felt like an imposter.
"Don't fret," Jock said.
He sat on the bed, tightening the elastic on his braces.
"You look fine."
I reached behind me to adjust the stockings again.
"Your mother doesn't like me. She just doesn't want to lose me. That's how mothers are."
He'd spoken the words so lightly that they stung. What would I know about it?
"She looks down her nose at me," I said.
"Don't be silly. You're my wife."
He got up and came to take my hands, giving them a strong, reassuring squeeze. But as soon as he let go, his words clattered to the floor. I didn't feel old enough to be anyone's wife, or that I knew enough, or had lived enough, or understood the essential things. I didn't know how to say any of this to Jock either, that I was afraid of the promises we'd made, that late at night, as I lay beside him in bed, I felt lonely and numb, as if some part of me had died. "Please kiss me," I said, and he did. And though I leaned against him and tried to meet the kiss and to take it in, I couldn't quite feel it. I couldn't feel us. I had never spent so much time by the sea and hated the way the air thickened with salt and sat on my skin and made me always long for a bath. I was far more comfortable with dust. Here moisture puddled on everything and seeped into the walls, swelling the windows shut. Black spores of mould grew on the walls of the houses, aging them like a skin.
"It seems wrong," I said to Jock. "Bombay is drowning, when at home we'd kill for even a little of it."
"It's not as if India has stolen Najoro's reign. And we are here. Try to enjoy it."
Jock seemed to like playing the role of tour guide at first, proudly showing me the bright bazaars smelling of curry and onion chutneys, turbaned, swaying sitar players, the polo fields and the turf club, which was so rich and manicured its gleaming grass put ours in Nairobi to shame. I held his hand and listened, wanting to forget all about the trouble at home. We were newlyweds after all. But when evening came, things fell apart. We'd been married for several weeks now, and I could count on one hand the number of times we'd actually had sex. The first had been on the voyage to India. I'd been seasick for much of it, particularly when we launched away from land at the Gulf of Aden and headed out into the Arabian Sea. The horizon stretched and pitched when I could stand to look at it. Before the nausea set in, we had managed to make love on my narrow bunk. But the whole thing was such a tangle of elbows and knees and bumping chins, I barely knew the thing was happening before it was over. Afterwards he kissed my cheek and said, "That was lovely, sweetheart." Then he crawled out of my bunk and into his, while I was left feeling just as lost and confused as I had been on our wedding night. Jock's drinking didn't help matters. At 4 o'clock every afternoon when we were in Bombay, we met the rest of the family on the veranda for cocktails. There was a ritual to it, I learned very quickly. Every feature played out to the letter. How much ice went in, how much lime, the air filling with a tangy zest that I felt at the back of my throat. Jock's Uncle Ogden was pink-faced, and always at the gin before anyone but Jock, settling in his chair under the jacaranda tree and dark, forever noisy jackdaws.
These birds have become our personal housekeepers in India,
Ogden explained with a strange note of pride, gesturing to a flock in the courtyard.
If not for them, the streets would be overrun with rubbish.
I watched one delicately pluck at the carcass of a mouse, then peck at a hillock of pale pink sand. What's he doing? I asked.
Cleaning his gullet, Ogden explained. A bit like rinsing your mouth after dinner.
I studied the bird, and then two others swooping in to fight over a smear of crushed mango on the stones, pecking with sharp beaks at each other's throats, ready to fight to the death. Somehow they made me sad, and long for home more than I already did. Too much was new about India, and the days had no anchor. Jock might have fallen for the bold girl I was when I was 14, but he didn't really know me any more than I knew him. We were strangers, and also together nearly all the time. I kept telling myself it would be easier when we were at home on our own farm, with work to do. It had to be. One night at the Purvises, the table was set with a feast that hardened and grew cold because Jock's mother had tipped back so much gin she'd forgotten the cook had called us in long before. She listed in the darkening courtyard and finally leaned into a potted palm and closed her eyes. No one else seemed to notice or care. "Let's go up to bed," I said to Jock.
"What?"
He tried to fix his bloodshot eyes on my face, lip-reading. "I'm exhausted," I said.
"I'll be right behind you."
I walked past the dining room with a table full of thickened and filmed-over curries, the servants too afraid to clear them away. In the bathroom, I climbed into the soaking tub, lined with painted tiles. One was of a tiger, though age had faded his stripes to a tired beige. Somewhere in India, real tigers roamed, hungry and roaring as Paddy had once roared. It was an awful thought that in a way I knew I would rather be wherever the tigers were, or even back in the muddy pig hole I'd spent several nights in the time I'd run away from school. At least then I had known what I was up against. I lowered myself into the stinging water and waited there for Jock until it ran cold, then filled it again. Finally I went to bed and curled up on the apricot silk sheets, shaking a little. "Dear Doss," I wrote on a picture postcard the next day, "Bombay is beautiful and glamorous. We've been to the turf club nearly every day, where Jock and the other members are showing me how polo is really done. You should see it all one day." I looked at the words I'd written, knowing I ought to be telling her or someone how miserable I felt. I didn't know where to begin, and what would it change anyway? I chewed on my pen, thinking of what I might add. Finally, I signed my new married name and left the card to be posted. Chapter 15. We were nearly 4 months in Bombay, and when we returned, British East Africa didn't exist anymore. The details of the armistice had finally been settled, and the protectorate dissolved. We were Kenya now, after our tallest mountain, a proper colony, with the graveyards to prove it. Africans and white settlers had died in the tens of thousands during wartime. Drought had stolen thousands more, and so had the Spanish flu. Disease tore through towns and villages, taking the thinnest and smallest, children and young men, and new wives like me. Demobilized farmers and herdsmen came home in despair, not knowing how they might begin again. I felt much the same way. At Green Hills, I expected to find my father and Emma packed and on the verge of departure. That had been part of my plan, to spend the worst of the dismantlement in Bombay. But the farm hadn't even been sold yet. My father hadn't made a move.
"I'm going to eke things out here as long as possible," he tried to explain. "If I can win a few more races, I might draw better buyers."
"Oh," I said, while inside my chest, everything shifted and slid.
I had run headlong into marrying Jock, believing there wasn't any other way. But now it was clear I would have had